We made this.
Welcome to the Starlight Ballroom. Hey.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Shipwrecked and Comatose, the Red Dwarf podcast here on the We Made This podcast network. My name is Kurt, and I am your host, lead host for this episode. And as always, joining me is my co-host, Mr. Mark Adams. Mark, how's it going, mate?
Hello, I'm all right. I'm enjoying Series 7 so far, and this one is considered a classic, so I'm looking forward to having a chat about it.
Good, good. Well, joining us for the second week in a row, it's Carl Bryan. Carl,
poke me a flipper there, Kurt.
Fantastic. Well, if you haven't worked out by now, we are going to be talking about Stoke Me a Clipper.
Is it regarded as one of the best episodes of the show, do you think?
I think so.
Mark, is that have we seen it in polls and stuff like that?
No, I think it's a favourite in as much as it's just so batshit. I don't know. It's a favourite of mine. Okay. Anyway.
Let's talk about it then. Let's just go dive straight in. You know, we had a bit of fluff last week, so let's just dive into this episode. It was episode number 2 of Series 7, directed by Ed Bye and written by Paul Alexander and Doug Naylor. Originally aired on the 24th of January, 1997. We find out that Ace Rimmer has been mortally wounded and is actually a hologram as well. And he comes over to the universe that our Red Dwarfers are all in. So, a return to Ace Rimmer. First up, we start off with another cold open in the form of a play on various different things. Now, what are your general thoughts on this, Carl, of the beginning to this episode?
I remember back in the day, I was thinking, oh, it's Bond. But it's more Indiana Jones, isn't it? I enjoy it. This is, for me, one of the slight issues with this series is the green screen's a little ropey, but it's still thoroughly enjoyable in terms of everyone who's in it is giving it their all. Like Ken Morley, who's playing the Nazi general, is blatantly, he's not just turning up to work for a paycheck. It's like, oh, I'm going to eat some scenery. Give me that rubber crocodile. You know, it's just good. I think you can almost tell that Paul Alexander's in there because it's a lot punchier for me in this one as opposed to the first one. There's a lot more gags in it while also balancing out the emotional stuff that we get to later on. And I just love this opening sequence in terms of it looks good. It looks like one of those 50s, oh, not 50s, maybe 50s, 60s, the where they had the, you know, the Angry Eight or whatever, where they were the rugged World War II veterans being sent back in for one final mission. They used to have all the acts like Peter O'Toole and whatever, you play all these ones. It reminded me a lot of that for some reason, but with this man clad in a Baker Fall jumpsuit in there. It's just really good fun. There's a couple of lines in it. It's very obvious in this one that the wig isn't the same. but he's very more, it kind of plays in a little bit when we find out what's actually going on with the Aces, in that he is slightly different in this, but he is slightly different because he's not the same one.
Mm.
And you kind of get that a bit in some of the speeches where the, this is my best top, damn it, didn't seem like an Ace Rimmer line. If you know what I mean.
He even says at one point, going, the cat! Like that as well, doesn't he, at some point? And it's like, it doesn't really ring true, but which is something I want to talk about, actually, as we get into the episode and talk about Ace and Rimmers and all that kind of thing. So, Mark, what do you make of this opening sequence, then?
It's so dumb, so daft, so cheesy, so cheaper, and I fucking loved it. It's just, it's actually terrible. The rubber crocodile is worse than the snake from Polymorph. The Corey guy playing the Bond villain is just so camp. So camp. And I loved every second of it. It felt like satire in a weird way. It felt like it was deliberately cheap. I don't think it was.
No, it isn't. Doug Naylor has made it very clear that this was not the original plan. And the crocodile was going to look super cool and all this, that, and the other. And it was going to be shot very dynamically. And it was going to be like this big thing. But I kind of think if they'd actually managed that and pulled it off, it wouldn't have been as ace, if you know what I mean. There's a certain degree of cheese that comes with Ace Rimmer. And yeah.
Yeah.
But this crocodile gets credited as well as Allison, doesn't it?
Yeah.
From the zoo. So that's good.
I love the German soldiers at the end.
Das war Ace Rimmer. Brilliant.
Yeah. I'm glad you both enjoyed it.
Did you not enjoy it, Kurt?
This is probably the worst thing I've seen in Red Dwarf up to this point. In fact,
oh, I agree.
It is the worst thing, and I cannot stand it. And I've had to watch it twice, and I hated every second of it.
See, I agree completely. It is the worst thing Red Dwarf has ever done, quality-wise. It just was just far too ambitious, and it became like satire. But because it became like satire, the kind of lover of B-movies in me just ate it all up.
I think part of the problem that I've got is the part of the satire is that I'm not an Indiana Jones fan. I'm not a James Bond fan, apart from the new stuff either. So the things it's satirizing is stuff I don't like in the first place. For that reason, I don't like Indiana Jones. It's too cheesy. Don't like James Bond. Too cheesy. Don't like the Chekhov's gun stuff in James Bond. Don't like that kind of thing. So the fact that they actually do that in this episode, it's like, I expect you to die. I'm like, oh, God. You know, and I just can't get my head around it. It's just not me whatsoever. So, yeah, this is the first real bad bit of criticism that I've got. I mean, I get it. I understand it. And I understand why people love it so much. And don't get me wrong. It's not, you know, this is not me like sort of dissing on Red Dwarf. I'm not doing that whatsoever. Otherwise, I wouldn't be on a Red Dwarf podcast. But this is for me, as I say, potentially, this is definitely in the top half of least favorite moments in Red Dwarf's history. And yeah, I don't find it good.
It's a weird one because about like a decade later, you'd have Doctor Who doing the things where they release like a 5-minute short between series. Like they did that a lot for a few series. And this
they were
would
called
almost
Tardisodes, weren't they?
Tardisodes. And, you know, they did like the short with Paul McGann to bring him back and tie that all together. Well, and I really like that idea. And this almost feels like they could have, obviously, YouTube and stuff like that was a thing during this time of Red Dwarf. They could have almost released this as a build up to Ace coming back. And I think it would maybe worked in a way of on its own, it maybe would have played a lot better to you. Maybe Kurt, but I think it would have worked as almost like an extended trailer, as just like he's back, Ace Rimmer. But it's kind of out of tone to the rest of the episode. But because it's a cold open, it kind of it's almost like a short film on this. It's like it's the short film before the main, not main course, main feature.
Yeah, and as I say, I mean, I totally get why people would like it. I mean, just everything it compounds the problem. I mean, it's not grounded the way I'd like it to be grounded, basically. That's kind of where I'm at with it, you know, because it is in universe. You know, it's not, you know, it's in a different universe, obviously, but it is in universe, and it's just that batshit that I just can't get my head around it. I mean, it even does a bit of Street Hawk in there.
I love Street Hawk.
One of the best theme songs ever.
I mean, if we're suggesting that it's what its sources are, you could even go as far as Star Wars saying that all the baddies miss and the goodie is the only one who's any good with a gun.
Yeah.
Well, he shoots a chain off from between the woman's breasts.
He does.
Yeah. Princess Bongella. How did Bongella not stand up for that? I was like, hang on a minute. But I suppose, no, the people I can't imagine Doug Nelly going, the people at Bongella are big Red Dwarf fans. You know,
I think the closest thing I got to a laugh was when he said, time for an explanation later, and maybe some checks. That's about the only thing. And it's basically, that's Sean Connery, isn't it? Kind of like illusion. But that's about the only thing. And again, I think it is biased on me not liking the sauce it's ripping off in the first place. I think the Indiana Jones stuff and things like that I really struggle with. And then obviously the alligator, see you later alligator and stuff like that, which is interesting. And it would have been interesting to see it actually done in a way straighter, because that doesn't feel like it should be. You know, as much as like I'm saying I don't like it, it doesn't feel like it would work straight either. It in theory, should work better this way.
Wasn't the initial idea he was going to be fighting simulants on a spaceship, and then it got changed to Nazis on an aeroplane? And there was like, all of a sudden, that's because this was part of the big fallout with the model team, was we want an alligator. And they were like, oh, okay. And they just had to find one. And when they got there, Doug Nail was like, well, that's crap. Where's the good one? It's like, that's your alligator. And then they said, oh, it's got to have lips. And they're like, alligators don't have lips. Well, this one needs to have lips. You know, I can see why this was a slightly troubled series production-wise, but it does work,
and that's why it's great. The alligator's wretched.
It doesn't work, but it works because it doesn't work kind of way. In terms of quotable dwarf as well, there'll be time for explanations later, and hopefully some sex. Would be quotable dwarf if it wouldn't land me in a hell of a lot of trouble.
Yeah, I wouldn't try that.
And Bongella's called Beryl Bongella.
Mm.
Good.
You get the feeling it's just one step off, like, whatever kingdom she runs, being like, you know, the Tartar kingdom or something like that, Cold Sore Peninsula.
Anyway, yes. So that was one I was really looking forward to talking about, because it was a struggle to actually even watch it. And I'm like, I looked at like who was hosting and I saw it was me and I was like, oh, okay. All right, okay. I've got to write notes and stuff. I was like, I was just going to say, don't like it. Move on. But anyway, let's jump into the next part of the episode. So we've got Lister. Lister, this is an interesting conversation that he has, because he talks about the fact that a man's got urges, a man's got desires. He can only take so many cold showers, et cetera, et cetera. So he's going into the AR machine to get some, you know, as a man's prerogative. And he goes into this medieval world. But just firstly, on that men's carnal desires thing, something I've not really picked up before in the past on this episode, but it's an interesting conversation he has with Crichton and this Carl, isn't it, really?
Well, they're 3 million years into deep space, and he's got the hologram of a person he can't stand, a mutated cat and a droid. It's, you know, when you do get that urge, you haven't gotten... Well, you have got options, but maybe they're not options that Lister really wants to go for. Even if he does, I don't think they'd want to go with him. But it's that thing, you know, you're trapped in... It's something they've always alluded to, even in like quarantine, where they're talking about the, you know, golfing, bowling, and of course the all-time number one and things like that, which is a joke I did not get as a kid. And yeah, it's the thing, because it's also been, I mean, is it Gunman of the Apocalypse where he's
with the woman from Spats,
snogging the woman from Spats, and I almost get
Loretta's name.
Yes,
you almost get the feeling that he's been barred from the AI machine because of that incident, and this is him just at his breaking point. Otherwise he would have been fine. Because going off Gunman of the Apocalypse, he was like porking his way through every Birchville character he could get his hands on. And he's been barred. And now finally he's just snapped. And because now we've got the new universes colliding thing, we've got the much nicer, much comfier looking VR machines than just the headset and the booth. These, you know, it's one you can sit down in.
And one you can have a groinal attachment with.
That's the thing. Yeah, the reveal of that is, for me, a very funny moment it's perfectly clean in a way, because you don't see anything. It's just Craig Charles's bare legs, which...
It's a visceral sex gag is what it is, and it works very, very well. It's grim.
Yeah,
it works in conjunction with the actual tent going up, bobbing up and down. Yeah. As well, the fact that you've got all these sexual illusions, you don't actually see the act, you don't even see them naked or anything like that at all, but you're putting the pieces together. You know, the chastity belt, you know, there's the groinal box that he talks about, which fell into Rimmer's soup. It's just littered with a lot of sexual innuendos and moments in this episode. I think even to the point where, you know, we've got Rachel later on in the eulogy, the widow. But we get some interesting actors in this as well. I mean, we talked about the opening scene. There was two German actors that were actually in the in that part as well. So it's kind of good that it was actually German speaking people. But Brian Cox is in this.
Yeah. And it's not like this was like during a down period of Brian Cox, I'm sure, because he's always been busy. But he must be a fan. I think that must be where it came from, is they just kind of, oh, it was one of those things where the planets aligned, like, you doing anything on Saturday? No. And sort of they get him down for, you know, it seems like Richard Dreyfuss will appear in stuff like Piranha 3D, do a line from Jaws, and it paid for his kitchen. Yeah. You know, it's, you know, there's all that kind of thing. And that maybe that was it for Brian Cox. But I think he is a fan of the show. He's that's how they got him.
But he was brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
Like, absolutely brilliant. Lister of Sneg. Yeah. Just brilliant.
It's one of them, like, you're only going to have about, what, 10 to a dozen lines? And he nails all of them.
From the actual stage as well, because obviously where it was filmed, I think the day he was there, it was actually really badly raining. They couldn't do much. Actually, a lot of the scenes later on are actually, you know, done separately. And then you've got Doug Naylor's sons in the audience as well, in the cast, which I thought was good. Anyway, it makes good use, the AR, actually, going back to the AR stuff, it makes good use of the cheats. And, you know, there's some marvellous moments with the chastity cheat and the steed cheat. To this day, I still find hilarious with that little donkey horse thing.
The little Shetland pony. Is this
is another thing as well. Must be something. Lister kills that guy. He chops his head off.
Yeah. You probably killed a guy in Call of Duty yesterday or whatever games you play. It's a video game.
True. It's just watching it today is like, oh yeah, but you never, yeah, it's a game, but you never really think of it out and out, just going, I'm going to chop this guy's head off so I can get some.
We really needed to get some, didn't we?
I mean, without sounding too laddie about it, Sarah Alexander is an incredibly beautiful woman. You know, yeah.
Is she? Yeah, cool. She is.
Yep, she is. Yeah, she really is. Very funny woman as well. If you've ever seen Smack the Pony, she's like the fourth pony. So you use the Python term, she's the fourth one. And she's really, really good. And Greenwick as well.
Yeah, she. It was really strange that I watched it last week. Watched this last week. And I was like, what else was Sarah Alexander in? I was like, Coupling. And I came off, again, similar to what happened in Northolt, I came off the channel and I was went on to, because I was on UK Gold to find Red Dwarf, I'd flicked over and Coupling, the first episode was on. So I've ended up watching like sort of the first 6 to 8 episodes of Coupling.
Good show. Underrated show.
Yeah. Never watched it.
Yeah, it's really good. And obviously with Sarah Alexander being in it as well, it's, yes, really good.
The cheats thing, it's so very, very 90s. I remember vividly owning the SNES and other people owning a Mega Drive at this point. And there was things like...
Up, down, left, right.
Yeah, I'll never forget up, C, down, C, left, C, right, C. And you got extra blood in Mortal Kombat, for example. And I can still do, without fail, you can fight the same character. You know, you can have Ryu versus Ryu on Street Fighter 2. I can do it as like muscle memory. I can still do it now. And so it was just so time accurate as well when they were doing this.
I thought two things. One, even though I can't remember ever using it myself, I know the Konami code because everybody knows the Konami code who's played a game. But the other thing was the fact he's saying it out loud just reminded me of spell casting. C-H-A. I love, again, I've spoken in the last episode as some of Crichton in this series doesn't sit well with me, but I loved how he is in this one where he's just so embarrassed to be there.
Yeah, he's so ashamed.
He's so ashamed. And the fact that Lister's making him stand guard outside the tent. He doesn't necessarily need to be there. So, but he's just there.
Oh, it's great, isn't it? I mean, the thing, as I say, with him looking ashamed, and you know, you've got the cheats and the thing, and then the power goes down. But just before that, he says, "Any got any whipped cream?" So he's really going for it. Is our Lister like?
Have you ever used whipped cream in the bedroom? Do not do it. You'd remember. It is not a good look. Would you like to explain why, or shall I spare
it? Leave
everybody?
It to my imagination, Mark.
Yeah.
It is not good. That squirty cream, no. No, no, no. Bloody squirty cream.
But only Brian Cox could sell the line whipped cream as well as he does.
There's a craft that is dimension jumping, which leads to a conversation. Was the last time someone did that? It was Ace Rimmer and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think the ship has got charisma and all that kind of things. What I particularly loved about these minutes is the way that Rimmer reacts to it is like sort of he's straight on the defensive, but just like sort of him banging his head on the table when it becomes it is Ace Rimmer. What I really found fascinating, and I say as much as I don't like the beginning part, I actually loved everything up to this point. Beyond that, is just the extra work that's been put in with like the group. You know, what I was saying about the group, like sort of really attacking Lister last week, that they all surrounded Rimmer to say you need to go and see him. The peer pressure was there to like say go and see him, go and see him. So I thought that was really fascinating for the show to do that. I mean, what did you make to that, Mark? Because this episode is all about Rimmer accepting his fate, but it's the way the team around him at this point is written that it does feel like it's like, you know, I know you don't like him, but you know, he really wants to look after you. He wants to he has a bond with you. And I just like that element of this part of the episode.
Yeah, I think Rimmer's banging his head on the console thing was a very, very funny moment. I laughed out loud at that. And I think his consistent hatred and jealousy of Ace Rimmer is always funny. But I do kind of feel like after season 6, episode 6, Aaron Rimmer's kind of proved that he's AC more than the impression is given in this episode as a whole. It would be less funny if he was more capable, but it does feel like it's a step back with no real explanation after he was so brave at the end of Out of Time.
Yeah.
For me, because that's like you say, the build up to I always like the fact the way Rimmer says morning when he walks in. It's almost like Rimmer's actually quite at peace. Like, this happens all the time. Morning, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And Ace is his trigger. You know, it's like that ex-girlfriend or that ex-boyfriend, like, I'm totally over them. And then they come back into your life. It's like, oh, you know, it ruins everything you built up. For Rimmer, it's Ace. You know, he could build himself up. He could do this, that, and the other. And then no matter how, especially for the sort of neurotic sort of level that Rimmer is, he could get to whatever level he wants. As soon as he sees Ace, he feels it's not enough. And that will cause him to regress. You know what I mean? And the group sort of pushing him towards Ace, to me, reminded me a lot of trying to get two friends who've fallen out to get back together, or two brothers who've fallen out to talk to each other. Where everyone else is like, look, we know this is, you know, just go talk to each other, because they all kind of know it'll be fine if you actually get to clear the air. But Rimmer's just being incredibly stubborn.
And it's closed off, isn't it? It's stubborn, closed off, and doesn't want to open up in that perspective, because he knows, as I say, Mark, that he knows he's capable now. But the fact that, you know, it is that trigger of, you know, it's a good analogy that an ex-girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever, or someone coming into your life that you just shut down, and it's a, you know, it's just, you just automatically shut your body down and don't really want to deal with it. And I do find it fascinating that it's the people coming back. It's like the old friend coming back, and Rimmer's got a real kind of a reflection of himself. It's like he perceives Ace Rimmer as being the better person of himself, but doesn't want to admit that. So it is like kind of a therapeutic thing that he needs that counselling to be able to actually get to the point to understand that. And this what episode does quite a bit.
Yeah, it reminds me of to reference another show from around the time, Due South. So you've got this Mountie who's like just dead straight down the line, you know, almost like superhuman sort of Dudley Do-Right kind of thing. And then the episode where his ex-girlfriend turns up and he wrestles with it, but eventually he attempts to throw it all away for this woman who he knows is going to drag him down the path. And it's that thing, I think, with Rimmer and Ace, and that Rimmer could do everything, but as soon as he sees Ace, it's all over.
There's some good jokes as well. You know, the only Bond I would like to see is a tube of super glue and a rabbit hamster. So there's good jokes there. But he is mortally wounded from the beginning, as we saw. And they have that conversation. You know, he's dying. So Rimmer has to open up to Ace because of that fact. You know, this is the last chance that he's going to get to speak to him. And I just like that as the swan song for Chris Barry at this point, that we are taking that viewpoint of, you know, of becoming the person he could be and actually he facilitates. I mean, Mark, you mentioned that at the end of series six, he does that. You know, he's capable of that, but it was that one heroic event that he's done and he's capable of so much more. And I find that Rimmer at this point is, you know, and they'll talk about Rimmer in future episodes, but at this moment in time, it's really intriguing to see that's what the kind of motion they're doing, that, you know, especially given what we see at the end of the episode where there's so many of them that actually become Ace as well. It's like, you know, it's not just that, you know, there's loads of different ones and they all do their own thing. They all seem to have this fate and destiny to become Ace.
Yeah. I think it's the whole episode is actually a really good kind of observation or commentary on someone's confidence. Mm. And how your friends and inspirations can change your confidence to the point where you can achieve things that you've always wanted to do but never thought you could. And it's really quite lovely in a lot of ways that it's done so subtly but so well.
Yeah. I mean, take for a fact as well, the way Lister's is dealt with right through this episode. So talking about the bond at the beginning, but then you've got the reverse psychology that he uses after speaking to Ace. He sees that, you know, this is their destiny. We need, and, you know, Lister has that affection for an empathy that he normally has, but always for Rimmer, and uses the reverse psychology. But then at the same time, you know, towards the back end of the episode where you've got Lister like sort of really trying to help, you know, I mean, some of the joking aside, but some of the real poignant moments are when Rimmer dies and, you know, the eulogy and at the very end where, you know, yeah, go on, man. And they have that conversation on the actual balcony. So they get those moments that you might have seen in, say, the first episode or the first season or the second series where, you know, you've got the viewing dome and things like that, those kind of conversations.
Yeah.
They have it on a balcony. So I find that the Rimmer and Lister conversation, you know, even though it starts with the family of people around that table, it does quickly become a two-hander with Lister and Rimmer.
I think the main difference between the season one, season two stuff in the dome that you were talking about and how Lister behaves in this is Lister's kind of tolerating and trying to vaguely be kind of helpful to Rimmer in the earlier stuff, whereas this really does feel like they've genuinely developed a friendship and that he's being an incredibly supportive friend to Rimmer. And I think it shows a big development in their friendship. And also he's clearly genuinely upset to see him go, but knows that it's for the best for him. And, you know, how many times have you wished someone well as they move away and do something that they have always wanted to do, but you're going to miss them? And I think Lister feels like that. And I think Craig Charles' acting is subtle, but it's clear that he's hiding the fact that he's being supportive, but he's genuinely quite heartbroken.
So, yeah, I think for me, the most powerful line in the whole episode is, are you really going to be the one to break the chain? because I think there for both of them, it's that push forward moment. In for Rim, I like the fact you don't see Rimmer's answer to that. Not in a kind of, oh, he still might be the one, in that kind of, you know, he's going to do it now. But I think for Lister, it's the thing of, it's become real. Like, he's been helping Ace, and, you know, it's been fun dressing up like a knight and everything like that to help Rimmer become the best Rimmer that he can be. But now he's realized, it's almost like he's realized, oh God, you're going to have to go now. And that's going to be the last time I see you, probably. And I think that is the moment for both of them. And only two people, I think, that close, one could say to the other, are you really going to be the person to break that chain? You know, if it was the cat, I don't think it would have meant anything as much to Rimmer. If Lister says it, then it means something.
Yeah. No, it's really eloquently done. I think it's probably not called out enough on this episode. And it's just something that, I have to say, that I'm watching it the second time around, it was like, that's the thing that I picked up the most, was the kind of like, he really wants you to be there. This is what you need to do. And the support that came from that, and as I say, that line, as you say, is something that has that, again, going back to what I said last week about those poignant moments that are written into Red Dwarf that can just turn you on a dime. And that's a perfect example of that being able to do that. And this is old school Red Dwarf. Old school Red Dwarf can do this as well. And it just really works in that way. And, you know, talk a little bit about Rimmer as well, Chris Barry. Chris Barry has a lot to do in this episode. He's got to become a new Rimmer who isn't quite a Rimmer. He's got to become a Rimmer, an Ace Rimmer who is a hologram who's not quite the original Ace Rimmer. He's also got to play Ace Rimmer as Rimmer. He's just got so many like sort of nuances to actually portray. And he does them all expertly. I think all the acting that he does, you know, some of the vocal changes that he goes from like sort of really high pitched to like low, and you know, and he's just trying to figure out stuff, I think is wonderful the way that it's been designed.
There are bits in this where you will believe Chris Barry can't do the voice. When he's being Rimmer pretending to be Ace, you would, because it's a bit like when they say it's really hard to play the guitar badly if you know how to play the guitar. Yeah. I can imagine if you know how to do that voice, it's really hard to botch it and do it badly. So, which, I mean, obviously he's had a lot of, over the years, doing voiceover stuff with Spitting Image and things like that, so that must have helped him kind of handle it all. But yeah, he's playing multiple layers of different people. Yeah. He's a Russian doll.
Yeah, and there's physical stuff, like when he tries to put the glasses on, he puts them on slightly wrong, and you know, and the manifestations that he's trying to use and actually make fumbling it and things.
His shoulders are up, I've noticed as well. When he's like this, he's uncomfortable in the suit right to the end. Like when he's sitting in the ship and he just looks like he shouldn't be in that ship, even though someone who's the exact same build as him was in it half an hour ago and looked smooth as anything. He looks like he should never have sat in that ship at the end, because he's all bunched up and the wig's kind of rucked up at the back. And yeah, it's fascinating it to play. You know, it's not him playing dress up, because he was the person that he's dressing up as. It's very odd, but brilliantly done.
I think as swan songs go, for both the character and the actor, had this actually been the last episode that you saw Rimmer in, it would have been an absolutely banger of a way to go out.
If the CG on the Rimmer graves was better and it didn't look so plasticky, I think this would get remembered in the same tone as Poppy Fields in Blackadder. I genuinely do, with the music and the way it's working and how it pulls out and reveals the ring. I think it would get remembered in that, you know, great higher up in great sitcom moments or great British TV moments, if it looked a little better.
The CGI is diabolical. The message and the story and the big reveal is superb, and it couldn't have been done any other way other than CG. But yeah, the CG is so
It made me wonder when the Blu-rays came out recently, because there was talk that they were redoing bits of, you know, color grading and stuff like that, whether they'd actually replace some of those things. But obviously you get people complaining like, you know, it's the prisoner cell block H thing. No, I like my CG to look naff. That's how it's supposed to look. But I'd love to see a cut of it where maybe some fans done an edit of it somewhere where it looks spot on.
Yeah, I think for me, it's like going back to the beginning of the episode that I do like those sort of moments where you've got like, you know, the little Rimmer being thrown out of the spaceship in the early series and it looking a bit hammy and the polymorph and stuff. I think for the beginning, that's, for me, it's a slightly different thing. It's more like the satire is not quite right. But the bit where you were talking about the CG for this, and like I said, I think it was last week on Babylon 5, is I couldn't get my head around that. And again, it goes back to the, like I was saying, with the idea of the some of the story elements, like sort of talking like Lister and Rimmer having that conversation is very old school Red Dwarf. This is kind of the stuff again, which is Doug Naylor is trying to push on, having those poignant, really kind of thoughtful moments. And the CG just doesn't do any favors because it needs to have, you know, it's difficult to have that moment. And then, as you say, it could have been a really good moment, and it is a really good moment. It's really kind of melancholy.
It's still a gorgeous moment, but it's that thing where it kind of irks you because, you know, it could have been better. Give it about 3 more years and, you know, it could have been. But again, I don't know how they've done it as a model, and I don't think they could have done it as a model.
No.
If they did, they'd be painting out a lot of bits of fishing wire.
And the thing is, it happens so soon after a moment that genuinely did get me, that really kind of grabbed me by the heart and squeezed. They all actually did the Rimmer salute.
Yes.
And they didn't do it taking the piss. He didn't, you know, lick his forehead. You never learn. It was all done out of genuine respect for something that this man had done.
Mm.
And then as a tribute to him. And that really kind of grabbed me by the heart.
Yeah.
And had the CGI Rimmer's Saturn's ring thing been even passable, those two moments in quick succession would have been just an absolute kind of heart-wrenching moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, isn't it as well? Because obviously it's a Saturn-looking planet. Isn't Rimmer originally from? Because he's from Io. Isn't that one of Saturn's moons, or is it one of Jupiter's moons?
It's one of Jupiter's moons, Io.
Okay, I thought if it was one of Saturn's moons, that was just a nice little touch. But
yeah, I mean, he's also made an officer as well.
So yeah, which is all he's ever wanted. Yeah,
yeah. So yeah, it was. There's so much in that moment that works just so well. What I think doesn't work quite as well, but would be great, this episode for me is a bit up and down, but is the training montage, the kind of like the Jedi, still talking about Star Wars before, but the kind of the training stuff on the magic carpet. I mean,
you could have got rid of the magic carpet. Yeah. It is one of the only moments that really lets this bit down is the magic carpet. Although Chris Barry's facial expressions when he's trying to visualize the cougar is nostrils on full, if this is my last one, we're going for a full Blair nostril.
I didn't mind this at all. I liked the scene. And I liked that they used that they'd established that they'd got a AR machine in the new version of Starbug with the Vista of Smeg thing. I kind of liked it. It was very kind of Star Trek having a chat on the holodeck kind of vibes.
Mm. I think it could have. I just didn't like the green screen, and because Ace has been action. Ace has never been.
He's playing Yoda, basically.
Yeah, he's never been Yoda, but again, this isn't the same Ace, but. It felt a bit out of character for Ace to be like, feel the wind through your hair and all this kind of stuff, because that didn't feel like him at all to me. He's more of I always found him more as a very kind of like rugger and, you know, and we're going, you know, not a not a dickhead bloke, but he's a bloke. He's a man's man. And in that kind of, and he wouldn't be there sort of spouting pseudo psychological stuff, if you know what I mean. And it felt out of character. But then again, like we say, it's not the same ace. So all aces are different. This could be the ace from Demons and Angels.
Can you imagine that? Can you imagine it? I had the same kind of feelings with the training montage. It felt like that between that and then the AR machine coming out of it, it felt very kind of Empire Strikes Back to me. With Luke, it did feel a bit Star Warsy. It felt like it's going to be the training montage, and you know, it has to fight an adversary. I wasn't that fond of the fight scene, if I'm being honest with you, either. But you know, it served a purpose, and I can see why they wrote that in. I did feel it was a bit of wasted time. I don't know if you enjoyed that element. I know that the AR was obviously brought in, and he's looking for Lister and Smeg as kind of a, you know, a way to like sort of throw the audience off, but I just didn't feel it kind of worked.
I did like the fight scene. It does come out of nowhere a bit, because it's never really explained how the knight gets out of the AR. I remember watching it at the time and not thinking, oh, this is going to be Lister. I was actually quite surprised. I thought it was going to be Rimmer was going to do something genuinely heroic. And then when Lister whips up the thing and reveals it's him, I was like, oh, and I liked that.
I thought it was a massive piss take of Star Trek, because they did have characters come out of the holodeck, and they had specific episodes where the holodeck characters invaded the Enterprise.
Yeah, Moriarty was the main one.
Yeah. I thought it was a poke in the ribs of that, because it wasn't a character escaping AR. It was Lister pretending to be a character that had escaped from AR, because it's absolutely ludicrous to suggest that a character would escape from a video game.
Would have been better if it was Brian Cox.
I mean, yeah.
Brian Cox versus Chris Barry in a sword fight.
I always get a chuckle when you do get like sort of the taking out the lie rounds and got blanks, and they just say blank on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Visual gag like again.
That. We mentioned Rachel earlier on, but the gaffer tape tie gets me every single time.
And it's uncomfortable.
The gaffer tape tie gets me every time. And, you know, we get a few callbacks to the Chief Eunuch, don't we, in this episode as well. So Alexander the Great's Chief Eunuch, but they mentioned Eunuch in the earlier scenes. Even the cat, even at this point in time, you know, says a few things, doesn't he, during the eulogy, which was great.
Yeah, it's actually remarkably lovely. I love, and I don't know if you two notice this, the look the cat gives Rachel.
Yes, like she's genuinely his mourning widow.
Yeah.
Yes, agree.
But I almost got this hint of that it was that thing of single now. So he's going to try and pick her up afterwards.
Brilliant.
Again, going back to some of the things that Chris Barry does, we say when he tries to do the buy iron balls. Yeah, it's stuff like that, which, you know, it's just playing up to that kind of yin yang of trying to be several different people at once, which I think is great.
And when Crichton asks him for a spare suit because the ship's run out of baker foil. I don't know why that was kind of a thing. It's like, why would you get annoyed about that? It's quite helpful if you got one. Also, it does say that Ace's suit's made out of baker foil.
Brilliant.
Brilliant.
I don't think I've got anything else. I mean, going, we didn't mention this. We mentioned it last week as well about the music. So, all the score as well is really good in this episode as well.
The Ace Rimmer theme is the second best piece of music in Red Dwarf history, as well as of the Red Dwarf I've seen. It is the second most memorable track to fucking Gunman, obviously. But yeah, it is so good that it could have been on.
I think it's Arnold Rimmer might be.
Nah, that's number three. It's so...
I vary on that from different days as to how I feel about that song.
But the music in this is so good that it would have fitted perfectly well in an Indiana Jones film. They could have had a Indiana Jones clone and you would have noticed that the music was good in it. And yeah, that's two absolute smashes of the music in as many episodes.
Mm. Yeah,
I always thought that the Rimmer theme was a bit of a playoff of the original theme song.
Because
you could almost play the original theme song into the Ace Rimmer theme. Because it's got that... It's a bit like the original theme song with a bit sped up and a bit higher.
Double timed, isn't it?
Yeah. But it works. It works really well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, the thing we've sort of kind of gone over, because we kind of skipped straight to the end almost on this one, because it's such a powerful bit, is the actual scene where Ace dies.
Yeah. Yeah. I did have that. I was about to go back to that, actually. Yeah.
It's very serious. Mm. It's the fact he does the smoke me a kipper, I'll be back for, and then dies. And it's a very Blake 7 sort of special effect when he dies of the invert.
Now, it's interesting that you said that, because that's the one note in my notes that I haven't actually got out, that it absolutely reminded me of the regeneration of William Hartnell to Patrick Troughton. Yeah. Like, uncanny. Right. The only difference really was that it was in colour.
Even though it does go mostly white, doesn't it?
Yes. But if you've got the opportunity to watch that regeneration, you'll see just how similar it is.
Yeah. And then you've also got the light beat, like, shining out its green light as well.
Mm. Yeah.
Like, sort of, which adds kind of like that regeneration kind of idea as well. Yeah. I think also, I kind of started to allude to it, but we jumped around a little bit, but the way Chris Barry acts and says, no, it's not you, it's me.
Yeah.
And then it's Lister who has to bring him round. So, you know, he's in chunk. Mm. You know, and Kat's like kind of like sort of Kat and Crichton are like kind of coming at it from a Red Dwarf's perspective. But Lister's quick to like jump on that and just go, Rimmer's died kind of thing. And I thought that was really touching.
Yeah. It's the look on Chris Barry's face as well, where he goes, hasn't he, Ace?
Mm.
And you just see him. He's not taking it in, but he kind of's like, well, yeah. But it's the push. Lister pushes him, that final bit he needs. Or it's the start of Lister pushing him for that final bit he needs. Ace's ship's a model.
It is a model, yes. Yeah.
So it must be one of the only model shots that made it in.
Yeah, and it does benefit from it.
Yeah. It's a great looking ship. It's different from the previous one, isn't it? It's got more of a...
Yeah, it's got like an extra...
dome thing on it.
Yeah.
And it would have been nice. It's got like
Formula One's halo. You know, the Formula One cars have now got the halo on it. It's kind of like...
If it would have been nice, because in the previous time we meet Ace, his computer's like, don't go, Ace, I love you. If ever there was a time for a Hattie Hayridge voice cameo, that would have been it. Just have Hattie as the voice of Ace's computer.
Yeah, that would have been nice, actually. Just any Hattie ever would be nice. I want Hattie.
Or Norman Lovett as Ace. Don't go, Ace. I love you.
I mean, that final thing, talking about like sort of, yeah, the because it is kind of like a replay of the driving seat thing, but the fact that he gets fired and he has to roll in front of all the crew. Oh, I just thought I'd say one more thing, and kind of goes along with the crew. Yeah, cheers, Davey boy. Yeah, good luck, man. which is just a lovely little touch, because it like leaves, you've got the poignant moment, but he actually leaves you on a little bit of a you know, a wry smile.
Yeah. I think it's one final insult for cowardly Rimmer, who is trying, because it is still our Rimmer. It is still the man who doesn't do so well very often. But the fact that he gets up, does it again, says that he's trying. And whilst it's a final humiliation, it's also kind of a comment on his determination as well.
Yeah, definitely.
So the question is, how many dimensions do you think Rimmer gets through before he gets killed?
He could Jar Jar Binks it. He could like massively Jar Jar Binks it and like look his way through like 10 or 12.
Yeah.
Fucking Jar Jar Binks. Yeah.
It's, I mean, in the list of spin-offs, there could be the Nova 5, which essentially would be the Golden Girls and Crichton in space. And then you could have Rimmer. It's when we've been doing the Smegazine episodes, there's been the odd Ace Rimmer strip in there where he meets different Rimmers.
Yeah, it would.
That would be a good spin-off in itself as well, just the adventures of Ace. And because when he comes back in 8, it's not that Rimmer. I think Doug Nail was like, oh no, it's that Rimmer. It's like, well, yeah, but it's that Rimmer from a previous timeline or earlier in a timeline. It's not the same Rimmer. Technically, it is the last time we see "quote unquote" our Rimmer, because when he comes back, it's a different one.
Yeah, is it? Obviously, I've lost count now, but it is a new Rimmer, and then you know we'll see where we go from there after series.
We're not doing that episode on all the Rimmers. There's far too much research involved. If we are, I'm not doing it.
I know. Well, I did say it, but it's becoming fast apparent that actually, you know, there's too many options. Because I think because back to Earth Rimmer is a hologram, isn't it? So it's
he's a hard light hologram. Yeah. And yeah, I think it's the end of 8.
Yeah.
In 8, he's human. In Back to Earth, he's a hologram.
10, he's a hologram.
In 10, he's a hologram.
So I think he's the same hologram, yeah.
Yep, 10, he's a hologram again. And it's, yeah, from what I need to watch the Dave series again because it's been a while since I watched them, but
I'm not allowed.
I can't remember if it ever truly gets explained.
You're not allowed.
No.
You're not allowed, sir. You will soon be allowed. We're not that far away now. Any final thoughts? What do you think overall of this episode, Mark?
I think it's batshit crazy. The cold open is massive satire and so bad it's good kind of stuff. And then the AR is clearly mocking Star Trek. And then suddenly it's incredibly poignant and about friendship. It's almost like 3 or 4 mini episodes in one. And I'm kind of like them all, which I know you don't, Kurt. So it's 4 mini episodes I like kind of coupled together with sticky tape. But I like them all. So this is, I think this is a great swan song that wasn't eventually a swan song, but it feels like a swan song. And I really like this episode.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's, as I say, I'm not fond of the, I love the AR bit after the credits. I really like the Lister and Rimmer stuff. I'm not as fond of the training montage and the AR coming out of the suite with it being Lister, but the poignant moments are really, really good again. So I think it's definitely a mixed bag, except for obviously the beginning for me is what, it's not, that isn't designed for me. So that's one of those things for me. What about you, Carl?
I really, really enjoy this episode. It is up there and some of my favorites. Like Mark says, it's essentially 4 things in one. Watching it back today, it's like, this is only 28 minutes and there's so much in it. Part of me thinking about it just then while you were talking is maybe it's like this because when they get sent over to America, it can kind of stop after 10 minutes for an ad break.
Right, okay.
Yeah. If you know what I mean. That might work, be part of it, but it just works. And the fact it runs the gamut of, you've got the silly stuff at the beginning with Lister trying to get his end away in medieval times, to Ace turning up, to if there's a weak, it's a good episode. If there's a weak quarter of it, it's the training montage. But the rest of it holds that up to keep it to such a high standard. And yeah, as far as farewells could go to Chris Barry, as we thought it was at the time, I don't think it could have gone better.
Do you think to kind of give you a bit of a dichotomy that the Lister getting his end away is designed so that you see that swing. You know, it's the swing from Lister being a blokey bloke to like being the one with empathy for Rimmer.
He does run the gamut of what he is. Even the most sort of compassionate friend, you know, understanding and empathetic and all that kind of thing, still needs to have sex once in a while. You know what? Yeah, it's, you know, they've still got your desires. So I agree. And, you know, I think it balances out in a way that gives Lister something to do at the very beginning, because if you went straight into the Ace is dying, we need a new Ace, and Rimmer's going to be that new Ace, I think it would be a bit of a shock to go straight into for the viewer. But because you've got Lister, you know, shagging away with whipped cream, it kind of eases you in a bit and then kind of sets it up for them. Because it feels, talking about it now, we're almost making it sound like it's like a good third of the episode. It's not. It's only about, three, 4 minutes at the beginning.
Mm.
But it's enough to kind of ease people in before they drop in some of the heavier, it's not like super heavy, but some of the heavier stuff with Ace dying and we need a new Ace and this is leading up to Rimmer. Also, it could give a bit of the thing to the viewers of, oh, is this not Rimmer's last one because we're in medieval England, you know, ripping off chastity belts.
Fantastic. Yeah, and Kat doesn't get much to do in this episode, but it is a vehicle for Chris Barry, isn't it? So, you know, it would be overfilled if you'd put too much in that way. And I think it balances that to a degree. I think that works quite well. Maybe, as I say, that training montage is probably the weakest. But overall, I still think it for me, it just swings from one thing to another a bit too much. But the Lister stuff, well, I think, works really well. So, yeah, that's the end of this episode. Next week, who have we got next week, Mark?
Colin's coming back and we're doing Ouroboros.
Colin's back. Ouroboros. Excellent. Well, Carl, thank you for joining us on Series 7. Might you be back?
I may well be back. We shall have to see. I
wonder why this might be.
See.
Our podcast has been designed with 6 episodes in mind.
I had to be very selfish and put 8 in this series.
So where can people find you, Carl, online?
People can find me on all my links at allmylinks.com/Mr. Carl. I'll be also launching my YouTube channel soon, where I react to Mark's previous podcasts and also moments in his wrestling career. There's been a very good one recently. If you have a look recently, there's one where Mark takes a very good chop. And he takes it like a trooper, bless him.
No, I don't. I fucking wither.
Like a trooper.
I wither like a trooper.
Yeah.
Get that man an Emmy.
Yeah.
There was no Emmy. He hit me really fucking hard.
Okay.
Oh, I'll put it on the socials if people want to see me get fucking lamped.
It was certainly brightened my day up.
Yeah. I just quickly, the other day, Mark and I did see each other in person and we were at a wrestling show and Mark was wearing a beautiful pair of almost like snake pattern trousers, a flouncy pirate shirt, which was very much like the Seinfeld puffy shirt. And at one point I saw him doing a martial arts kick with a pair of nunchucks in his hand. And it was the coolest Mark could feasibly look in that outfit.
There are a lot of words to describe me, Carl. I don't think cool will ever be one of them. But yes, I did super kick a child on that show. I'd like to point out he's 20, but I call him a child because he's significantly younger than me.
That was my side eye. I was like, do you want to?
No,
want
he's to really, not like, a child.
Nail that down a little
he
bit.
Looks like a child. He's like my wrestling nephew. And if I was going to kick anyone, it would be here.
Excellent. So if people wanted to see you kick children, Mark, where can people find that?
I mean, follow me on Twitter @MarkAdams8C. I put my wrestling stuff on that. If you fancy coming to see me. I mean, I'm not likely to kick a child on a show, I'll be honest. I'm more likely to ring announce a show for you. But, if, you know.
Bring your kids to a show. Let Mark kick
no!
your kids.
No! Shit, this has escalated far too quickly. No, if you are genuinely interested in seeing me do wrestling stuff, I put which shows I'm on my Twitter, and it's I've got gigs in Manchester, Liverpool, Stoke-on-Trent and Derby. Yeah, keep your eye on that. I've got podcasts as well, but fuck it.
Yeah, we can find me on Twitter at rmuldrake. It's RMULDRAKE. All the stuff that I do is also on there. So finally, without further ado, this has been this week's episode, Stoke Me a Clipper. But until next time, remember...
Do you want to take this, Carl, or shall I quickly come up with something?
That was just me coughing. That wasn't me doing it.
For the entire course of the podcast, no one's realised we've just had COVID the entire time.
Do you know your Daleks from your Dreshigs?
Or your Zygons from your Zagreus?
Do you know what the TARDIS stands for?
And do you know which Doctor Who stories featured Kevin Grimlock, the cyborg T-Rex that became the Doctor's companion?
Then this is a Doctor Who podcast for you. I'm Baz Green, and in each fortnight I chat to my son Ben.
Hello.
And the occasional guest as we cover 60 years of Doctor Who on TV, Big Finish, and more.
And I did really enjoy that one. Except that wasn't really actual pirates, it was badger pirates in space, but it was still piratey.
Pirates in space?
Yes. But I am willing to make an exception for pirates this episode.
Donald Sumpter is amazing. I love the fact that he just pops up. He just pops up, probably Rassilon, probably.
Well, they do confirm later on he is.
I think they do.
Yeah, he says on Rassilon the Redeemer.
Of course he does, bloody hell.
And he has the gauntlet as well, which gives the hint of that.
Yeah.
I'm nodding profusely.
Yeah. Great proper classic Doctor Who as well, love it as well. Yes. Lore.
In a week, has done more for the show than the last 5 years.
I do like how Ross D. Davies is kind of the PR spokesman for the Centuni special. That's quite fun. Yeah.
And he's also saying, oh, well, Jodie and Chibnall still have an episode left. I'm not going to tread on their feet, but he is 14, just so you know, for the filming purposes. And a week later, oh yeah, by the way, these guys are back. Just thought you'd want to know. Find us on the We Made This Network.
And all good podcast providers.
What about the bad ones?
Yes, them too.
Ah, good.
Because somewhere there's danger.
Somewhere there's injustice.
Somewhere else, the tea's getting cold.
You know, we probably should throw that tea away now. It has been sat there since 1989.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast, was created and produced by Mark Adams and Kurt North. You can find us on Twitter at Red Dwarf Pod, and we are part of the We Made This Podcast Network, which can be found online at wemadethispod.com or on Twitter at We Made This Pod.